life sounds like. I'm alive, I'm alive, I'm alive.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we're back with Gail Sheehy. We've been talking about Sherry Turkle's remarkable new book, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age.
If you have a soulful relationship with somebody, let's say it's a boyfriend or even a mate that you're estranged from, if they send off an email saying, you know, we're finished, or even I'm sorry by email, that's not going to do a thing. It's only going to rub salt in the wound because they haven't shown the courage to actually have a face-to-face conversation about what can we do to resolve this.
You know, actually, there's one woman in my book who says that if her boyfriend says I'm sorry over a text, it's 100% certain, she says, that issue is going to come up in conversation. Because as you say, nothing is resolved.
Right.
Hit I'm sorry, and when you say I'm sorry and hit send. Because an apology is a very complicated dance of you're looking at someone's eyes and seeing that they're hurt.
Right.
Realizing that they see that you're sorry and that you also are in pain because you hurt them, and then if they see that, you know, you really are contrite, you sense an opening where something new can happen. This is a complicated dance of empathy, of each party putting themselves in the other's shoes. And we learn so much from it, and nothing is learned from I'm sorry and hitting send. And our children aren't getting a chance to practice this. And this is the kind of very basic kind of bedrock of relational skills that they need to learn.
Sure. Well, the empathy, as you so well describe it, is really the route to intimacy. How can you actually be intimate with another person unless you have both exposed some of your vulnerabilities? That's saying, I trust you to hold this vulnerability and not to hurt me with it, right?
Yes, well, you know, vulnerability is a very, very big part of my story because really what another way to phrase what I found is that people are using their phones or using texting or using messaging or using social media to have relationships in which they don't feel vulnerable.
Right.
You know, even something as simple as the fact that my students don't want to come to office hours. They want to send an email instead. And when I ask them why, since I really do want to see them, you know, they say things like, I can write you a perfect email.
You don't want perfect.
And then you can write me a perfect answer to my question. And, I mean, first of all, this notion that, you know, at midnight I'm going to be writing them a perfect email is kind of silly. But anyone who loves learning, anyone who has ever been inspired by a professor knows that it isn't because they wrote a perfect letter or got a perfect letter in return. On the contrary, it's because they came in with something imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
And were told, you know, this isn't so good, but that doesn't matter because I'm here for you. I'm with you.
Right. Yeah.
I'm in a relationship with you. I'm in a conversation with you.
Mm-hmm. And you
so
can help them
come to a very transactional idea of what being together is that really isn't serving us well.
Right. Well, early on, Sherry Turkle, you thought that using social media to explore different identities would be helpful to the struggle that all young people have. But does it also, does presenting a perfectly crafted identity on Facebook really help, or does that help to create a fake identity because you want to attract more likes?
Well, early on in the 90s, what interested me about virtual reality is that people could create avatars and explore alternative selves, and I really wanted to kind of wake psychologists up to the idea that this was an interesting thing to study.
Mm-hmm.
Humanists and psychologists and anthropologists were not interested in this world. So I saw myself as wanting to say, hey, you know, this is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Get interested in this.
Yes, you were way out in front.
Yeah, but then what happened was that something changed. And what changed is that we now have our devices always on and always on us.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that at any moment, while I'm in an interaction with you, I can also be with all of my friends on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never fully give you my full attention, because the moment there's a lull, the word lull, the word boring bits, the word, you know, the notion that at any moment when there's just kind of a moment of quiet, when you're not being amusing, I will turn to the people in my phone for more stimulation. That's what kind of turned me around and made me feel that there was something here that was amiss, that people weren't giving people a chance. There's one girl who I interviewed who said, you know, she called it the 7-minute rule, that it takes 7 minutes in a conversation to sort of see where it's going to go. And she said, I'm not willing to put in my 7 minutes. I go to my phone first.
Well, you know, she was giving you more than a lot of people do. It might be, you know, 2 minutes, and then boom, they're off on their phone.
It might be 30 seconds.
It might be 30 seconds. That's the scary part. And I wonder if it isn't almost a vicious circle, because if you can't give your attention to somebody else, or you can't get their attention right away, then you have to start focusing on yourself and kind of talking to yourself, or fixing up your Facebook profile, or tweeting.
You go to your phone.
Yeah.
What I really found in interviewing young people, but again, not just young people, is that there's kind of a parallel play of people being together, but being on their phone, coming up from their phone to kind of chat for a minute, and then going back to their phone.
You were in a session like that. Tell us how it affected you.
Well, I describe a session like that when I was interviewing a bunch of people, and they said, you know, to really understand what we're about, you have to also get on an app that we're on called WhatsApp. So it's a kind of texting app. And so we had the conversation in the room, and then we had the conversation on WhatsApp. And it was dizzying, and really nothing got said in the room. We had started to have a really interesting conversation about going to college, about loss, about families, about coping. And then as soon as we were in many places, you know, we were sort of no place.
Yes.
And people were kind of dipping in and out. And one student called it the rule of three. And what he meant by that was, if you're in a conversation with six people, let's say at dinner, three people have to have their heads up, you know, talking before he feels that he can put his head down and go to his text.
Oh, that's pathetic, really.
So it's kind of like a new etiquette that means that some kind of conversation stays alive, but it's really not a conversation that matters.
That's right. And
that's what we have to look out for, that we're starting to be in a lot of conversations that don't matter because we're dividing our attention.
And let's talk about the kind of conversation that does matter, what you're arguing for in reclaiming conversation.
Well, the kind of conversation that matters is where you pay full attention to someone and let spontaneity happen, mm-hmm. let a moment of boredom happen, you know, because it's so often when we stumble or hesitate for a word or fall silent, that we reveal ourselves to each other.
Right, and I might...
We're humanity, and we have to leave room for that, rather than say, oh, well, if that happens, I go to my phone.
Right. Well, I might pick up on, if you hesitate in the middle of telling me a story about something that's happened to you, I might think, she's really hurting. I want to reach out to her.
Yes.
I want to ask her...
Or that's really important.
That's
in other
right.
words, the hesitation is a punctuation
that's right.
of anxiety, mm-hmm. or of import,
mm-hmm.
or of really needing to gather your thoughts because it matters to you, or of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I think there's kind of a dumbing down of what we're willing to hear from each other.
Right.
you know, if we're only willing to hear if we're used to just sort of seeing what a text will give us, or it's flattened out with a lot of exclamation points, or you know, whatever. But you know, in a the voice and the body communicate, you know, so much more.
Absolutely.
And we want to make sure that we don't lose the most precious gifts that we have as human communicators.
Absolutely.
You do lose that if you're looking up and down from your phone to the person, from your phone to the person. So my book is not anti-technology. It's pro-conversation. If your technology is bringing you closer to people, if it's giving you new possibilities for relationship, you know, I'm all in. But I've just met a lot of people who feel that, that something is amiss and it's time to, you know, to kind of recalibrate. And that's what my book is about.
This is Lee Habib, and this is a part of our weekly series with Gail Sheehy, our daring segment, Women Who Dare. And if you want to learn more about Gail's work, go to SheeheDaringProject.com. That's SheeheDaringProject.com. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories. The last two segments you've heard from world-renowned author, journalist, and lecturer Gail Sheehy's twice-monthly feature, Women Who Dare. This week's feature was with Sherry Turkle, an MIT professor who dared to be a pioneer in the study of the social and psychological impacts of technology. Gail, thanks for bringing us this terrific profile.
Well, I'm fascinated by this story, Lee, and particularly since I was a fan of Sherry Turkle, our subject, when she wrote her book years ago, 10 years ago, saying, wow, this social media is wonderful. It's going to allow young people to explore their identities and have, fake figures that they can imagine, avatars. They can imagine themselves as, you know, a power girl or a monster. And it'll be good for them. And we should look at it because it's an important psychological and sociological phenomenon. And nobody was interested but she. Well, then 5 years ago, she came along with Home Alone, and she began her reversal of saying everything is wonderful about social media until she came back, comes out with Reclaiming Conversation, and now it's getting really serious. And I think probably anybody, parent, maybe not a 25-year-old who's totally wedded to social media, but almost anybody else over that age has to be aware that, you know, we're doing something that's potentially destructive to our existence as human beings. And we need to modify our habits to preserve what we most value. In the case of social media, we have to save our capacity for empathy and genuine human connection.
Well, you had that. There was a point in the interview where you talked about eye-to-eye contact, Gail. And there's nothing more, you know, windows of the soul being the eyes. You know, talk a little bit about how, you know, in this interview, you were learning that so many kids, well, even as they're together, they're not actually together. They're sort of quasi-together, but they're really, the main interface isn't the human being in front of them. It's actually that phone.
That's right. So they put the phone up on the table while they're sitting around together, and they have, some of them have like a 3-minute rule. As long as they'll give 3 minutes to the person they're talking to, and then they have to look down at their phone because they get bored. Well, you know, boredom is actually maybe gives a chance for the other person to take a breath and then really say something that matters. And to constantly interrupt the eye contact, which, you know, when you look into the eyes of a dog and a dog looks back at you with its soulful eyes, that is a dog saying, hugging you. I mean, it is oxytocin gets released, you know, the connective hormone gets released and you feel affection and concern and maybe understanding. Well, you can't feel that when you write, you know, sorry and hit send and off it goes. It has no human dimension. So, I mean, I think that Sherry Turkle's book, Reclaiming Conversation, is daring in the way Rachel Carson, Silent Spring, was daring. Now, Rachel Carson, 40 years ago, was warning us about degrading our environment.
Yep.
And now we have an emergency meeting coming up in December of world leaders to try to slow down climate change before we pass the point of no return. And it can take that long for people to understand when we're doing something potentially destructive, but also, you know, we like doing. And
yep.
we need to change our habits, and it really has to start with adults, parents, and employers, because as you say, the employers are the ones who may make it's, you know, you live or die in a job on how fast you answer the emails from all the clients and customers. So I think to preserve what we most value in the case of social media, we need to save our capacity for empathy, because that's true human connection. When you can put yourself in another person's shoes and see in their eyes, see in their facial expressions, see in their body language what they're really communicating, because 75% of the way they communicate is nonverbal.
That's right. And, you know, interestingly enough, you talked about this thing, boredom. And, you know, it's in our daily lives, in the rhythm of daily lives, that sometimes you're not speaking to the person you're next to. You're going through something. This need to be perpetually entertained and with upbeat material, by the way, also, Gail, we were just talking about that Snapchat girl. And we know that in Facebook, people don't post their worst moments on Facebook. They only post their best moments.
That's right. And so the whole temptation about the web is, it seems like, oh, wow, you have this vast public space to tell the whole world about yourself. And so, but, you know, you may experience it as the most private space in the world, but you easily forget that these self-reflections can become dangerous when they're shared with millions of strangers. And even more so, using social media like an all-point selfie exposes us to harmful attacks and perhaps equally harmful self-delusion. And this 19-year-old model from Australia, Instagram star, who made a splash on social media last week by using Twitter to denounce social media as a fake. But then she's telling us that for the 4 years since she was 14, all she's been doing is taking thousands of pictures of herself, posting on Instagram and Snapchat, for which she gets free clothes and products from brands in exchange for influencing her 600,000 followers by faking the perfect life. And suddenly, at 18, she shuts down all her social media and makes a crybaby video about how false her life really is. And then she gets slammed by friends who say, well, she's really faking it now. This is all just a publicity stunt. So that girl is going to have a lot of work to get back down to who she really is from this fake identity that I think so many young people develop by putting up that false identity on Facebook or other visual mediums, and then coming to believe it, and then not being able to live up to it because nobody's perfect.
Yeah, we're learning also, Gail, about the deep interior and online lives of so many of these mass shooters who found their, quote, friends in these weird little circles around the country, unbeknownst to their parents or anyone else. If these actual friends had happened, if you could actually see the friends in the town and you saw a disturbing coalition of friends gathering, you could be on it with some counselors and all kinds of intervention. But when you can't see it, it's also a place where kids can get into some pretty dangerous patterns together.
Absolutely. And getting feedback from people who don't know you, can't see you, but you know, think you sound so incredibly brave and aggressive, and you know, you're willing to do anything to eradicate whatever it is that's bugging you, you know, they get cheered on. And they're also, they know they're leaving this incredible legacy of power on their digital footprint. And I think it just all builds to the point where this whole narcissistic aspect of people who have mental problems is fed by being able to make yourself a hero on social media even after you're dead.
You bet. You know, my dad, Gail, was superintendent of schools in Bergenfield, New Jersey, when six kids drove into a parking garage and committed mass suicide. It had never been seen before, something like that. Well, within a year, there had been a dozen copycats. And kids with notes were hoping that they'd get the attention. And the Center for Disease Control actually came in, Gail, studied it, and determined that the media should not only name the names of the kids, that they gave recommendations about how the media should cover it. Because so much of it had to do with actually the feeling the kids were getting from these final moments in their own, before there was social media, they had their own little media circles, Gail.
Right. And of course, when they're really young, I don't know, it's not until we're something like 17 or 18 that we're capable of full self-reflection, of being able to look at, you know, how we're acting and who we are and whether we want to correct that. So as long as you can have this vast public space that portrays the, you know, the illusion of the person you want to be seen as,
yep,
this totally powerful, aggrieved, hurt person who needs to get back at society.
This is Lee Habib, and this is a part of our weekly series with Gail Sheehy, our daring segment, Women Who Dare. And if you want to learn more about Gail's work, go to SheeheDaringProject.com. That's SheeheDaringProject.com.